Media Masters with Paul Blanchard.
Welcome to Media Masters, a series of one-to-one interviews with people at the top of the media game. Today I'm joined by the journalist and broadcaster Gemma Morris. Starting off in local radio, Gemma went to work for ITV and then the Houston Chronicle before joining Sky News, where she's now worked for 10 years. While working at Sky, she's also fronted Channel 5's lunchtime and weekend news bulletins, presenting the shows as well as producing and editing them. She now presents and produces Swipe, Sky's weekly technology programme, and works on Sky's multi-platform journalism, producing content for the channel's on-demand services and social media platforms. Gemma, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Paul.
It's very exciting,
isn't it? I'm excited to be here. I've heard you interview loads of different guests.
Well, listen, tell us about Swipe, because I'm a big fan.
Are you? I love meeting Swipe fans. We put a lot of work into Swipe.
You can tell. You're all over the world, all this exciting adrenaline and everything. It must be the best job there is.
I love it. I love it lots. It's a weekly tech show, as you said, and that means I spend a lot of my time tracking down great startups and entrepreneurs with brilliant new concepts and products, because I like to give those people a platform. And it's a consumer tech show, so we don't make it for tech experts exactly. You know, we want everybody to be able to watch it. So Sky News has a wide audience, and we also swipe on various other Sky channels too. So we know that we want everyone else to get it. So I always think when I'm producing and presenting an episode of Swipe, I always think in my head, will my dad get this? Will he understand what this new device that they're showing me, that this entrepreneur is showing me, is? We try and break it all down and make it digestible. So I do that for the most part of my week. And the rest of the time, I am, as you said in my introduction, I'm taking care of Sky News' other content on various platforms now, whether it's on demand or our over-the-top platforms or social media. And that can mean anything from writing, producing and presenting our little one-minute Twitter bulletins to managing Sky News' journalistic content on Apple TV or Roku or Sky Q.
And are you based at Austerley, or do you work for Milbank as well?
I'm based at Austerley 99% of the time. However, I'm always out on location on Swipe filming days, and I rarely go to Milbank, although I will be going there this week just because the two filming locations this week are based in Central, so it's easier for me to go to Milbank and feed back what we call rushes and then carry on with the rest of the work there.
So do you find that the culture at Sky is much more entrepreneurial? Because some would say the BBC tends to be a bit more staid.
I would say, having worked at Sky for 10 years, I've seen it change a lot in that time. But every step of my career at Sky, I felt a real sense of autonomy to be entrepreneurial, I suppose. So if I only started reporting because I went to certain bosses and said, I've got this story and I think it's really good and I'd really like to go and do it. And actually, could I please also be the person that voices the package and does a piece of camera in it? And obviously the answer is never yes straight away. You have to prove yourself. But I think that I've definitely been given opportunities at Sky where I don't really know if I would have had the same opportunities elsewhere. I've never worked in a staff position at the BBC, but I'm certainly very appreciative of that culture at Sky where you can put yourself forward and say, I want to be considered for this. So can you let me have a go or can I not? And if not, why not? And what can I do about that so that you can change your mind next time I come and speak to you? So, I've always been very grateful for that.
But you must be enjoying yourself at the moment because you're fronting Swipe, you know, they're on social media. You've got one of the best jobs in the world, it would seem.
I love what I do. We work so hard on that show and it's two of us each week. Nobody does Swipe full time. There's no full timer. There's a presenter, me. Then there are four reporter/producers who rotate. So they'll do it once every 4 weeks.
But then they've got other duties, have they?
They've got other duties just like me. So I need to Swipe 2 days a week and the rest of the time I'm doing all the other content and journalism stuff I mentioned. So none of us do it full time, but yet we're always working on it. So, and that's not a complaint. So on my day off, I'll be Googling different people, different places, because I need to find content for a weekly show. I do it every single week. I have to find something either for my demo section or to anchor the show from. I need a place to do it that's obviously got to link to the content of the show. So I feel that pressure every week. And sometimes I can't even relax until I know where I'm going to film next week and the week after the show, because I get a bit pedantic about it. And knowing what's coming up in next week's show isn't enough for me. I need to, in my notes, have an awareness of who I'm going to book in for the week after that and the week after that. And then I can relax a bit. But I would just hate to, you know, come around to Monday and be like, oh, who are we putting in the show? We haven't got anyone. But luckily, we always find something and we work well together. We're a small team, but it works well.
So does being so heavily involved in the production make you a better presenter? Would you ever want to just solely present and have a production team behind you? Or do you enjoy the hybrid role at the moment?
I love the hybrid role. And I couldn't imagine presenting Swipe without also producing it. I think that would be a lot of work for the producer to just lumber him or her with everything else that goes in the show that I currently look after. And I wouldn't like it, because I always imagine myself in others' positions. And if I was producing Swipe and then this Gemma Morris just rocked up to say a few things out loud and then went home again without putting any other work into the programme or any other organising or writing of scripts, I think I'd get a bit resentful about her. But no, I love it and I love presenting it. And I get to therefore choose the demos I do each week, because quite often, if anyone's not seen Swipe, quite often I'll do a demo section where I will interview somebody or look at a product in depth, something new and something sparkly or something that an entrepreneur is really trying to get off the ground by kickstarting. That can be anything from a self-heating cashmere coat to glasses that help blind people to see because it's got a little wire and a microphone that tells the person in their ear what they're looking at. All kinds of things we've covered. And I wouldn't be able to choose those things if I wasn't also producing the show. So, yeah, I love that autonomy.
And what's the rationale for choosing then? You mentioned that you've got to kind of not dumb it down so that someone like your father can understand, but in terms of the actual choice of the products and the topics.
My dad's not that basic. Yeah. He's not that basic.
But he's not a techie, is he?
No, he isn't. But, you know, we don't necessarily have to even dumb it down, because we are all, first and foremost, journalists. None of us have specialised in technology from way back. We are all Sky News journalists and we all turn our hand to Swipe because we love it. And so there's never a point where we think, oh, this is just so complex that only we can understand this, so we better just omit all these details. Part of the job is looking for topics that people will be interested in, that a wider audience will be interested in. So that's why we see it as a bit of a consumer technology program, because we want to look at things that will intrigue people. And they are usually things that will affect or could possibly affect their everyday lives.
So how did you get into this? Because you started from the more traditional journalist career at the local radio station. Is that right?
Yes, Radio Jackie, the Sound of Southwest London, where I learned a lot about not just being a journalist, but how to read the news.
So you wanted to be a broadcast journalist right from the get-go?
No. I went to university to do journalism, print journalism predominantly, because I was quite good at writing and I had done I'd done photography at college, and I had also done a documentary film diploma in making documentary films. And I wanted to stick with photography and I wanted to take photography to degree level, but I didn't have the wealthy parents that could afford all the equipment I needed, because back then you were switching from manual cameras to digital and it was all super expensive and I was never going to keep up with the other kids who had that kind of money.
The wealthy benefactors.
And I knew I was a good writer. I'd done very well at my A-levels and sociology. I remember I used to enjoy essay writing randomly. And I thought, oh, you know what? I wanted to do first journalism, but it's not going to happen. Why don't I do journalism? And enrolled on my print journalism course, got in. And while I was on that course, I managed to somehow wangle 3 days of work experience at ITV. Through somebody that I knew. Anyway, got in there for 3 days.
ITV or ITN?
It was ITN. But
so it was at Gray's Inn Road?
Gray's Inn Road. Yeah, yeah. So the wider company, I suppose, was ITN, but I was working on the ITV news programme. So in my head, it was just ITV. Mm. So there I was and loving it, and got to go and shadow reporters and went out and about with the cameramen, which meant you could meet many reporters in one day because the cameramen moved from job to job, and I really sort of interviewed them all about what they were doing. I thought, oh my god, yeah, I love this.
So you were getting the bug even then.
I want to do this. Then I managed to talk ITN into letting me come back on a holiday. I think it was my East holidays. No, it must have been summer holidays, because there I was doing my few weeks work experience at ITN when 7/7 happened. And that was in July. So it must have been my summer holidays. And that moment really, really hit me, as I'm sure any journalist covering that event will have been impacted by it. I really felt in that moment that being a journalist was such a crucial role to disseminate the news right now, to let people know what was happening. And that really stuck with me. And this was all during a time when I was still deciding what I wanted to do in terms of which journalistic path. And so that just made my mind up for me. I knew that I wanted to stay in broadcast. So I completed my print degree, got a first, and then got on an internship at Sky News. By that time, I'd already built up experience at Radio Jackie and ITV. I mean, ITV, I was pestering them so much to let me come back and do more work experience that at one point, the boss at the time said to me, yeah, we think you're great, but we can't keep you coming back, because we actually will enter some difficult water with HR, because there's only so much.
There's only so much work experience you can do.
For free. Yeah. So anyway, then they started paying me as a freelancer. So that actually was fine in the end, and I quite enjoyed that. But I think that, yeah, to answer your question, that made me think, definitely I want to stay in broadcast.
And you clearly had the thrill for kind of breaking news. I mean, I've done that as well. We've had Richard Conway on this podcast, actually, and I was once in the pub with him, and he got a tip from a source on his mobile phone, and he worked for Sky News at the time, and he rang the newsroom and said, right, this is it, this is laid on, this is definitely true. And we were in the pub, and it had a Sky News, you know, on the TV, and then the ticker went yellow with what he just said, like, seconds later. And I remember even me just sat next to him. It was thrilling to be part of a kind of breaking news experience. And is that the bit that attracted you then?
I wouldn't say just that, but that is an exciting element. And I know that when you've been at Sky for some time, you feel as though it's your family. And I will call the news desk probably before I call the emergency services if I ever found myself out somewhere and something big was happening. I mean, the other day there was a fire across the road from my fiance's flat, and the first thing I did was ring the news desk and say, look, there's about 7 fire engines here. Here's what's happening. And then, you know, and then they can ring and check it out from the right sources. But so that's very exciting. I can understand why you were impressed by Richard's calling the news desk there. But no, that wasn't the only thing that attracted me to news, the breaking news aspect. It's the build-up of the experiences that I had had from way back at Radio Jackie, and also the American newspaper, the Houston Chronicle that I was working for. All of those experiences accumulate into this one desire to continue in journalism and keep doing what you're doing, because there are so many different aspects that I love about it. It's very satisfying. It sounds very cliche, but it's amazing when you actually feel like the stories you're reporting on affect those within the story in a positive way. I love it on Swipe that we're effectively giving an entrepreneur with a bright idea a platform to talk about, look, I've got this thing, and you know, whatever it could be. It could be the other week we were looking at a headband that conducts sound through bone. This could have implications and uses for people who are visually impaired or cyclists. You could have it inside your cycling helmet. So then you could be aware of buses or whatever coming up behind you without having to look. So you're giving people like that a platform, and it means so much to them. And it could mean so much to the people watching who it would actually affect if they ever wanted that product. And I love that satisfaction. I love it when I get a deeper story away from Swipe, when I've reported on things like, I remember reading about pregorexia, which is effectively pregnant women.
I don't know what that is, but I've worked it out just from the word. That's awful.
And I remember going to my boss and saying, can I do a report on this? This just feels like something people should know about. And then when I contacted a scientist at Great Ormond Street, and she had this mind-blowing statistic about the number of women who worry about their weight
during pregnancy
to an abnormal degree. Like, it's beyond sort of, oh, I feel a bit big. It's, you know, borderline eating disorder.
And does it harm the baby? I would imagine it would.
Well, and then the woman in my report, she, credit to her, she was very open about speaking about the effects that it had and that it could have had if it had been even more serious on her unborn baby. But it's stories like that that I think, I feel like I'm doing a service highlighting things like that. Another example, I did a piece about a woman who was about to die of cervical cancer. And it was a package I put together to remind women to go for regular smear tests, because she was essentially saying, the woman, the mother, she had her two children as well, she was saying, this is my fault. I didn't go for my last smear. Essentially, her message was, look what's happening to me now. Please don't let this be you. And I found it so moving. And I think that the emotional impact of journalism has been a key factor in wanting to continue with it and stay with it and stick with it.
I mean, clearly they're quite serious issues. Do you worry that, I don't know what the kind of journalist equivalent is of typecasting, but Swipe is a very kind of engaging, upbeat technology show. Do you think people might wrongly pigeonhole you as a kind of science and tech presenter, and that you might not get asked to do that serious type stuff?
Well, I was never asked to do the serious stuff. Pregorexia and I've done a few others that were serious issues. They're not necessarily somebody coming to me and saying, I've got this great story, we want you to do it. It's a mixture. It's a combination of me going to what we call the planning desk and saying, I've heard about this, I'd like to go and report on it. And they will say, oh, yeah, okay, it sounds good. Or well, give us a bit more information and we'll think about it. There's a combination of that. And actually, for a short period, I was doing what I would call a weekend VT. So every now and then between my Swipe duties, I'd put together a report to run one weekend on a Saturday or a Sunday. And they would be pieces that could be more feature-led, as in if I was reporting on them on a Monday or Tuesday, they would be okay to run Saturday, Sunday. They weren't breaking stories. And some of those were given to me. Like I did a piece on childhood strokes. And that was given. It was like, Gemma, we found this story. Do you want to do this as your weekend VT? And I was like, oh my, yeah, I do. And that, again, is another eye-opening one. I particularly love health stories. Health and tech and where they merge, health tech, is what I really enjoy.
I'm enjoying the image of you pitching into the planning desk just like us PR people do as well, that they're sitting fielding, pitches from all sides and all comers, you and me both.
It really is like that. And they welcome that because they welcome anybody within the company or from outside the company who has an idea that would make compelling Sky News coverage.
They must get a lot of kind of spammy approaches from PR people. I mean, I'm on various databases to do with this podcast and I must get about 10 or 15 terrible press releases every day because I'm obviously on some database.
We get a lot of pitches for Swipe. But I love working with PRs because sometimes I can think of many Swipe shoots which have been long and demanding, and we wouldn't have been able to do it without the PR there to organise a timetable of events. So it's usually a big set day or event if there's something happening in the tech world where we really need that sort of organisation. I remember doing one episode on the art of the thrill, the tech involved in the art of the thrill. So it ended up being a 7-hour shoot at a theme park.
I was thinking roller coasters as soon as you said it.
So I then interviewed the head of this roller coaster society club while we were on a really scary ride. We filmed it at 7 a.m. So they'd open the park early for us to come in. So yeah, there I was on the road. So the concept was, I'll interview the head of the roller coaster society about the art of the thrill while we're on the roller coaster. But then we had to do a lot of retakes because obviously we had to get different angles. Yeah. And so we had GoPros as well. And then, I mean, before 7:30 in the morning, I had gone round this ride, the full loop, about 7 or 8 times.
As a recce.
Before breakfast. Well, it's just as well it was otherwise.
But a lot of kind of modern and, dare I say, kind of younger journalists do have quite a positive relationship with PRs. They're there as one source amongst many, and they can often be a good source of stories and a good source of relationship building in the long term.
Yeah, definitely. And they're great organisers to have on the date. So like at theme park, our PR was fantastic because she was able to liaise with everybody we wanted to interview, get everybody in the right place. So we would turn up and be like, okay, great, we want to start filming here. And she'd say, yep, you can do this over here. And here's your next guest for the VT. And here's your interview. And it's fantastic. And I love getting stories from PRs, which will make a great demo in the show. So if somebody contacts me, I don't want to give away any upcoming Swipe episodes. But if somebody contacts me and says, we've got a special suit that you can try out. It's a motion capture suit at a video games development studio. Then immediately I'm visualizing. I visualize every email I get from a PR because TV is visual. So I'm visualizing, how is this going to actually look on TV? And I always say to the PRs, but what can I point a camera at? What can we actually look at? Because if it's just interviewing a CEO, it doesn't always play well on telly.
You'd think they'd know that already, though, wouldn't you? Indulge me then. What do PRs get wrong? How could they... You know, we do have quite a few PR people listen to this podcast. So if people are pitching stories to you, what shouldn't they be doing? And what other should they be doing less of?
I'll go with what they should do. And many do. Many do. I love working with PRs. I think they're fantastic. I would say always put visuals first. So if I get an ideal email will be the title will spell out exactly what I could have in the programme. Mm. So it will be like, for example, let's take the motion capture suit example, which we filmed this episode at this Games Makers, and I got to try on this suit and then got to show viewers how motion capture works. So let's pretend I'm the PR for that company. The email should be something like, try out motion capture suit / see the future of games, or inside the studio, how it works, something like that. So we know exactly what we're going to get for the rest of the email. And then within the body of the email, just tell me what we can point the camera at, what I can have a go at, what we're going to see when we're there. We all want something that's going to be exciting.
Tell us about your interest in health. And you're really into this kind of super healthy living, aren't you? And biohacking and allergy research and everything. I mean, it's definitely a strong interest. How did you get into it?
It's a strong interest based on probably personal experience. I think you'll probably find that anyone who has an interest in health, there's probably a reason for that. So I have a life-threatening allergy to nuts, and that prompted a lot of allergy research. And I even did a report for Sky News on life-threatening allergies. And I met this little boy who has more than a dozen allergies, and I'm still in contact with his mum. And I still talk to her over Twitter about various allergy-related issues as they come up in the news. So that, and also as a teenager, I had some issues with blood sugar level, and that meant that I had to quite substantially reduce the amount of glucose in my diet, and in fact, sugar of all forms, whether that's sucrose or lactose, maltose. And so that kind of put me on the path to having optimal health, or at least trying to achieve it. And I think the term biohacking is now becoming quite popular these days. But anybody can do biohacking, and it can mean anything from going to the gym to just cooking your dinner slightly differently, because it's just a way of experimenting with what works with your body and your biochemistry. So you might find that you get a headache when you eat food that's slightly overcooked, and it might be something to do with the way that you're cooking it. So try and cook it without char grilling it so much. I mean, there is a lot of research now into overcooking foods and the potential carcinogenic effects, things like that. I mean, they sound really minor, but people are fascinated by them. I'm fascinated by levels of ketosis. So I will experiment with myself on how my cognitive function varies depending on the level of ketones in my body. So ketones, if you think of ketones as fuel, so you can be burning sugar for energy, which most people are sugar burners, or you could be burning fat for fuel. So I try and tailor my eating some days so that I'm mainly running on fats, like a high fat diet. And then I can experiment with different levels of ketosis, because some people claim that there's much more mental clarity with certain levels of ketosis. And some athletes now are switching over to this fat for fuel kind of training method. And I got to interview perhaps the world's most famous biohacker the other day, Dave Asprey. He's a great advocate of a high fat diet, but the right fats. It has to be the right fats. And it was fascinating speaking to him, because he spent near to $1 million now since the 90s on hacking his own biochemistry to just see what works for him. And like I said, it can be anything from changing your diet, or it could be just dimming the lights in your house, which there are some schools of thought that would say that has an effect on the chemicals in your brain, which could then help.
And our smartphone addiction, of course. Everyone on Twitter writes all the very final moments before they go to sleep, and the light isn't very good at all, is it?
I know. Well, I always keep my iPhone in nighttime mode. So I've always got that sort of...
It's too orange
...shade
me.
Of red
I'd rather
phone.
Just have it in the normal mode and then not sleep. Squeeze out an extra
wouldn't.
Few moments on Twitter.
Well, I'm experimenting, and that's what biohacking is all about. You're just experimenting with different things, and perhaps you'll experiment with the lighting that day, or other days. Like, some people believe that if they exercise for long periods of time, like marathon running, that it's more inflammatory than if they did quick bursts of energy, bursts of exercise, like Tabata training. I'm a big fan of Tabata training. And I also experiment with sleep and anti-stress gadgets. There are various kind of heart rate variability devices that I have at home. And I did an episode of Swipe on it. I wrote a piece for The Guardian about de-stress and mentioned how beneficial these things could be. And I kind of used myself as an experiment and wired myself up to all these different gadgets and devices, tracking my heart rate and even the kind of sweat on my fingertips, so that you would hold this chip and it would tell you how stressed out you are and then talk you through breathing exercises to chill out. And, you know, these things can and do, as the evidence suggests, affect your biochemistry. So you can boost levels of oxytocin. And in a woman, that's fantastic. But you can also boost levels of oxytocin by having a hot bath. So there are many ways. And I think the experimentation has really become a fascination for me.
And you're clearly way ahead of the rest of the society in terms of reducing the amount of sugar in your diet. I mean, the media are giving it quite a favourable hearing at the moment, but I've been lucky enough to work with people like Dr. C. Malhotra and Robert Lustig and all of these people. Robert Lustig famously, of course, having the multi-million views on YouTube. It's an odd position, isn't it? Because the evidence seems to be quite supportive of a low-sugar diet, and the media seem broadly supportive, and yet there's this huge mass of industry-led scepticism. Do you ever worry that you're getting slightly into campaigning mode when you're covering issues that you have a defined position on?
Well, I'm very careful not to take on that campaigning mode. And in fact, when I interviewed Dave Asprey, I declared to my bosses that I do follow this guy on Twitter, and I personally do take a great interest in a lot of the stuff he says. But the piece I'm going to do for Swipe is going to be an interview with him. I'm going to sit down, I'm going to talk to him, and I'm going to put to him that perhaps his methods are slightly dangerous. For his hundreds of thousands of followers, he's leading them into dangerous methods, which I did put to him, and he responded. So, you know, I'm always going to put my professional hat on for that. But you asking me about my personal interest in health, I can tell you here and now that, yeah, that is a fascination for me, and the tech that can enhance health.
So does the thrill of breaking news attract you? Would you ever want to sit, you know, at Austerley, right in the centre of things for 4 hours and anchor 4 hours of rolling news coverage?
Well, for about 3 years, I used to present live on Sky News through the night. And I say for 3 years, it wasn't every night for 3 years, but for about a 3 year period, I was one of the relief presenters. So our regular overnight Sky News presenter, who would be on air from midnight till 6 a.m., would be, say, on leave or off sick or wherever, and then I would be one of the people that they call in to present.
Do they call it the graveyard shift, or is that just in my imagination? Because it's the least glamorous of the shifts, is it?
Well, not on the other side of the world. You're on your prime time hours, the other side of the world, aren't you? I was employed by day at Sky. I was one of the presenters for the multi-platform service, so I was writing news bulletins and presenting, and also doing Channel 5 news.
You're right, I'm full of shame now, you're right, because I work all over the world, and I do watch Sky, you know, when I was in Japan recently, and it is the overnight coverage, isn't it? You're right.
So,
how UK-centric was my question.
Yeah, well, exactly. Well, now you know, and you won't say that to the next overnight.
But there's fewer guests that could come on.
Fewer guests, admittedly, although you could do a phono from somewhere, Singapore or something.
And imagine if there was breaking news, you'd have to do that.
Well, you do. And I did. I remember one of the first shifts I ever did overnight presenting on Sky News. There was a big story. A couple were released. They'd been held hostage for some time. And all of a sudden, I'm going live to one of our correspondents in Nairobi. And just at the same time, calling up all the information I could, just Googling on the screen while our correspondent's talking. And like you say, you are trying to keep your head around everything going on within the studio and on wires, which we call wires. It's various news agencies that deliver stories to us electronically.
We've had the editors of those wire services sitting in that chair.
Oh, of course you have. Yeah, and I've listened to that very podcast, so I should have known that. Indeed. Had all of that going on in my head. And obviously you're thinking of your next question. And this was early days for me. And as I said, I was the relief presenter. It was a big deal. And it was, like you say, about that breaking news excitement. That wasn't something I craved, but it was the environment I worked in and I loved it. I loved doing the overnight shifts, but I felt this enormous pressure to have to know everything about anything, because anything could happen. And the people that do it full time, like Kay Burley, like Jeremy Thompson, like Jane Secker, all the Sky News presenters and from other broadcasters. They're brilliant at it.
They're amazing. I'm a big fan of Jeremy Thompson. Been trying to get him on the podcast for ages. I actually did Live at Five a couple of years ago with him, and he read the autocue bit that was introducing me and what I was about to say, and then it just said cut to questions, and he just effortlessly turned to me, and as effortlessly as he was reading from the autocue, just started asking questions. And I just thought, this is amazing. He's a fantastic broadcaster. And do you aspire to that kind of level then? Because, I mean, presenting Live at Five would be a fantastic gig, would it not?
I presented overnights whenever I could between my day job presenting at Sky.
Well, that must have been unbelievably tiring, to state the obvious.
Yeah, I never really adapted to the overnight cycle. The producers that you're working with overnight, you often swap stories with them, like, oh, how do you handle it? I can't sleep in the day, and I can't. And we all swap like various tips. I'll try doing this. I'll try eating a meal when you get home at 7 a.m. But they're all very good at adapting, and although admittedly, you know, everybody struggles at times with those hours. But I do think your question about JT and a Live at Five role, for me, I've found a role now that I love, and it's a lighter style of news, and it's mainly feature-led. When I was presenting on the main channel, as high octane and exciting as it was, I don't think Sky thought that that was the right place for me to remain. And to be fair to them, I see it now. I mean, at the time when one particular boss was explaining to me that I didn't quite have the gravitas that was required to be a Sky News anchor full time, for example, I felt a little bit bruised and was like, well, what do you mean?
I think they're
why,
unfair.
What do you mean? But I see that in hindsight, they were right. I mean, I was sitting in a chair that Kay Burley and Jeremy Thompson sit in. I was 25, 26. I'd been a broadcast journalist, a radio journalist, but I didn't have the well-established experience.
But they were 25 and 26 at one point in the past, surely.
But they weren't anchoring Sky News at that point.
And you were. So I would say you're already ahead of them in the career. That's all the more reason to keep you on air. And I suppose the real question is what you're happiest doing, isn't it? Because there's no point doing it if that's not what you wanted to do.
Well, I think it all turned out for the best because it was what I wanted to do. And I was loving it while I was doing it. But then it came to a point where I was saying, well, can I do more presenting during the day? And I think I did now and then. I did what we call a wheel on a Sunday afternoon, which we call it the news. It's like a 2 till 5 p.m. shift. And then I carried on doing a few overnights whilst I was doing Channel 5 during the day and the weekend. So my shifts were, you know, I managed them, managed to put them in the right places so that I was still healthy. But it just came to a point where Sky was straight with me. I appreciated their honesty in telling me, we don't think you've got the gravitas that is needed. And I just took it on board and said, all right then. And in the meantime, I saw this program Swipe that had been, well, it'd suddenly been born in part of our iPad department. We had the new Sky News iPad app that had launched.
Martin Stanford used to do all the tech stuff, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he was great. And he had another tech show on the main channel as well. But Swipe initially began within our iPad team, and I was a presenter for the iPad app and the mobile app and the digital platforms. So I would write and produce these bulletins and present them, and then they would get sent off to various stations and kind of, I think they went in black cabs, for example, these videos of me presenting
the news. Used to run them in the advert breaks for Sky News International.
The international fillers. Mm. Yeah, and they would be sent to various mobile phone customers. We had clients everywhere. I was doing that and loving and enjoying that.
I'll tell you one thread that seems to run through a lot of what you're saying is that your ambition seems to be self-evident. Yeah, I mean, would you say that someone starting out in a career in journalism has to have unbelievable amounts of ambition now, given, you know, the fact there's no journalists in newsrooms anymore, print's dead, there's lots of people competing for that internship at Sky? Is it just
are there no longer journalists in newsroom anymore?
Very few of them. I mean, Jeremy Vines sat there, said when he was on the Leicester Gazette or whatever it was, there used to be like 50 people on the newsroom, and now there's like 3. What's the antidote to that? Just even more ambition?
I think anyone entering a career in journalism will work out for themselves what skills they need. If they're really ambitious, I assume they're going to end up doing something they enjoy, because a really ambitious person probably isn't going to give up until they get to a post where they feel satisfied. And then they'll probably want more as well. And there's nothing wrong with that. But if you're looking for advice on should I or should I not have ambition, I think it's innate. You've either got ambition or you haven't. I don't think you can tell yourself, I'm going to be more ambitious.
As you start to, you know, work with some of your colleagues over the years, is it a bit obvious that who might succeed and who might not in terms of, you know, whether they've got the X factor, you know, whether they're going to work hard enough? I see it in PR. I see people that are very good, but, you know, just lack that certain ability to go the extra mile, or they seem more in love with the process rather than the outcome. And you think, you know, I don't want to criticise colleagues, but on the other hand, you think, I don't think you're going to go far. But there again, I might be wrong.
I found that pretty much every single person I've ever worked with at Sky has been sharp, witty, talented. Otherwise, they wouldn't really be in the building, is my belief. So I don't judge people on how they're performing now as a way of dictating where they will get to. Because to be honest, I'm too concerned with my own path. I think everybody is. You know, you've got to be looking out for where you're going rather than monitoring where everyone else is going.
What are the stressful aspects of your job then? What are the bits that, you know, you would change? Grumble a bit.
Grumble a bit. I haven't got much to grumble about. I do feel under pressure, as I said, to fill with good content my section of the show every week. This is Swipe I'm talking about. Mm. And also finding a location, because the only reason Swipe is presented on location is because a couple of years ago I went to my boss and said, can we stop presenting it in the Chromakey studio, please? I want to take it on the road. And he said, okay, go on then. And since then, every single week I've presented it from somewhere.
Because you can always tell it's Chromakey. You just have to look at the hair. Anyone's hair, you can tell straight away whether it's green or blue.
Exactly. Yeah, and initially it started off as me saying, go on, let me take it on the road and present it somewhere new each week. And my boss was very understanding and said, okay, yeah, well, off you go then. So I did. And now I've created a rod for my own back because I have to find location every week. And I believe it doesn't look as good if we're back in the studio. And I haven't let that happen in 2 years. So there's always a lot to discuss. So there's that pressure as well. It's putting the show together and also meeting the deadline, because we have to have this show ready to air on a Friday, Saturday and Sunday. You know, we have to deliver it to the other Sky channels that need to air parts of it too. So there's that pressure always. And the pressure of not only filming a segment for the show, but making sure the segment is good, that is interesting. Sometimes you really have to be so creative. You turn up somewhere and you think, wow, this is the most boring room I've ever seen in my life. But we're about to film a segment in here. How are we going to do this? Well, let's think. Could we do lots of close-ups so no one can really tell we're in a really boring room? Or should we focus mainly on the hands and this new tech that we're looking at?
Shoot from an unusual angle.
Unusual angle. Just stay really close on my face all the time. Just ignore the background. But no, I mean, that happens rarely. But every week I feel that we have to really pull on every creative grain in our bodies to try and make the show look as good as we can and never be complacent that we have this programme, because you never know what can happen in our industry. We're always very grateful for the fact that we get to go out every week and choose what stories we want to cover, choose the content of the show and meet amazing people with amazing brains.
Some journalists can't bear to see their own work and see themselves on air. Are you different? Can you look at it critically and say, right, that needs to improve, but I actually quite like that bit?
It does make me cringe a bit. I often check that I've delivered the programme to the right platforms. So if it's my job to send the show through to Apple TV, for example, then I'll check that it's gone up, or catch up, Sky News catch up. I'll often go and just check it's on catch up, because if it hasn't got there, then there's been a hold up somewhere in the chain and I'll chase that. But I don't think that's me. That's me looking at my face. That's me checking that the show has reached the platforms it needs to be on. Or if it's not on YouTube yet, then I'll call the social media department and say, has Swipe gone up yet? Is it going up? Is it? Because we want to tweet it. We want to promote it. So, yeah, I'm looking for the show after it's edited for those reasons. But I do find it really uncomfortable to sit down and just watch me. I find it even more uncomfortable with other people in the room.
You just can't be objective, can you? Because I've honestly thought some of these interviews were terrible, and then other people have said, no, I would tell you if they were terrible. It was quite good. And then other times I've thought, that was quite a good interview, and someone said, oh, that, I thought it was a bit weak.
Well, your interviews are great.
Oh, thank you.
Do you know, but interestingly, you've just reminded me the other day we were watching one of my links in the edit suite. And I said, so what happens is the show's edited on Thursday and Chris was putting it together with our editor, Dave. And I went down to basically sub the show. So I watched the show before we click publish, basically. And I said to Chris, oh, what? I stumbled on my word there. Did you see that? And him and Dave are like, they didn't. Yeah, look, play it back. Oh, like I can bear to listen. Oh my God, I'm fluffing my words. Both of them swore that there was nothing wrong with my delivery. So obviously we left it, published, it's fine. That's for me to just shut up and deal with, stop being a perfectionist, imagining things that other people can't see. Or they could have just been sick of me being pedantic and wanting to get out of there. But that's an example of what can go wrong if you do watch yourself back because you start to criticise yourself too much.
Do you think the news is going increasingly digital now?
I think it has to. It certainly has, and it will continue to. I know that a lot of the content we produce at Sky News now, we're always thinking of our mobile audience. Obviously, Sky News has been a television brand, an organisation, and that will remain the spine of what we do. But certainly, I think a lot about the mobile audience and Facebook especially. I mean, Sky News's Facebook page, I think the audience has grown by about 400% in 2 years.
Incredible.
And we tailor a lot of our videos for Facebook, for obvious reasons. We know that people will stay on Facebook for about 45 seconds. But, for example, on YouTube, someone will watch a Sky News documentary for 15 minutes. So we're always keeping that in mind. And I think for journalists, the digitization of the industry means that we're all having to adapt. And lots of people talk about this disruption, this digital disruption, but I think it's a real process of evolution. I think it's a great thing.
Because gone are the days when Sky News was just merely a channel on 501 and you either watched it or you didn't. Now it's everywhere. Like you say, you follow breaking news alerts on Twitter. It's on Facebook. You know, it's via the website. I use the iPad app. It's all over the place, isn't it? And I mean, and that kind of those differing touch points are exactly the way that people can choose the way that they interact with it.
Because there are so many different audiences. And even now the development of filming in 360 or virtual reality, that is giving an audience much more control over what they're watching. So we don't have to just watch, we as in the audience, don't just have to watch what the cameraman is pointing the camera at. You can be viewing in 360 and moving around, looking for yourself what the surroundings are without waiting for a cameraman to do it. It's much more engaging and it's much more interactive. But also, talking about social media, have you ever done a Facebook Live?
No, and I'm trying to unfollow all of, because a lot of these social media apps now are starting to realise the notifications button is what really attract them. So Facebook says, oh, there's 8 notifications. You think, oh, I've got 8 friends that are interested in what I do. And 7 of them are always, you know, CNN was live, wherever.
I love a Facebook Live. You must watch the swipe ones.
Absolutely.
They're always fun. So for anyone who doesn't know, if you want to do a Facebook Live, you're literally just pressing live on your Facebook page and you can go live. And I do them from behind the scenes at swipe shoots and we get lots of comments. And sometimes I'll be interviewing some guests or we'll be demoing a product and then I'll take questions from the audience on Facebook. So they'll write little questions like the other day I was testing out something called a C-board. It's a completely new instrument. It's one of the keyboard family, but it's a lot more special than that. You have to watch the episode to see. But people were commenting, how does it work? Who's it for? Why is it so expensive? And then I can put that directly to the people in front of me and answer the Facebook audience's questions. It's so much more interactive.
It's witchcraft is what I say. Well, but there is a serious point, isn't there, that Sky News as a channel, Sky News, the actual channel is now just the platform upon which everything else is built, isn't it?
Well, we know that we don't want to take content from telly and just shove it on a mobile app because it doesn't work.
Mm.
But I think it's fair to say that Sky News did make a name for itself as a TV channel. Half of the traffic on our website is via a mobile phone. I mean, these are huge numbers here. So it's not a sector that we've neglected, certainly. Now it's all about cracking video so that it's perfect for those other platforms as well.
What's next for the channel then? Because it's always been an innovator, isn't it? It went to HD a few years ago. I've just ordered Sky Q, so I don't know. I actually don't know
Great.
What that is, if I'm honest.
Oh, you'll find out. You'll be impressed.
So what do you think's next then? Where will you go? Will you go to 4K HD, virtual reality, 360 views? Tell us what's... Yeah, I mean, you're the best placed person to tell us what's next.
Well, I think that's a question for my bosses. You have to see what contracts they're doing and what deals they're negotiating behind the scenes. I wouldn't like to speculate too much, but it will be exciting because Sky News always is, and Sky News always innovates.
A great on-message.
A very on-brand, aren't I?
On-message, on-brand note to close it. Gemma, thanks ever so much for your time.
Thank you.
A Big Things Media production.
Big Things!